Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. I'm Daniel. This is Nate. And we are live today on this one. Now, I realize if you're listening to this on the podcast later, it isn't live for you. But we are live here. We've got a bunch of guests. And this is yet another live that we're doing. We actually did one a couple weeks ago. We had so many questions, we couldn't get to them all. So we thought we'd just follow up. Obviously, there's been some time since that last one. We've had some really cool episodes. The episodes with David Chang, Greg Ginter. We had another episode with Alyssa. So many good episodes recently. But I wanted to get back to kind of our roots, which is how, you know, Grow Your Music Studio started and what you and I have done in Seven Figure Music School, Nate, which is connecting directly with teachers and school owners and answering questions that come up for people as inevitably we experience challenges or obstacles in our business or seek to take advantage of opportunities that pop up. So, Nate, I got a huge list of questions here. We haven't gone over them in advance. This is all off the cuff. I'm ready to jump in. How about you?
Love it. It's the way I work best. Let's just dive right into it.
Cool. All right. The first question comes from Scott, who is here. So Scott might even, call you out, Scott, if that's cool with you. But I'm just going to read his question. I love this question. One of my most liked and valued teachers is a young woman who has decided to take the summer off to participate in a music festival related to her long-term goal performing in a symphony orchestra. She would like to leave in May and come back in late August. I don't want to lose her, but I'm afraid if I tell her students she's taking the summer off, then they will follow suit and we'll lose the business. We offer lessons year-round. Should I hire a replacement and then try to work the first teacher back in the fall? Should I find a temporary summer teacher? Should I just tell her that I'm afraid we have to part ways? Thanks for any advice or insight. And actually, I will add one more thing because I actually spoke with Scott earlier this week. And it even came up that there's a little bit of a fear of if he allows this teacher to come back in the fall after having basically abandoned a huge number of students over the summer, that it might send a bad message to the rest of the staff that such behavior is acceptable. So Nate, this one, I wanted to lead off with this one because this one is just... this is a gold mine and a stick of dynamite all at the same time. So do you want to jump in first? Actually, I want you to jump in first, actually.
Okay. Well, this is a great one, Scott. Yeah, because it's got a bunch of levels to it. Let me see how I would summarize the issue. The issue at the core of the issue is business is sustainability of the business over 12 months. The summer is always historically a question mark for a lot of school owners, right? And at the same time, you're well aware that we're in the people business and what we do, because I know you as a great piano teacher yourself. Like, we're in the business of mentoring these kids. And of course, this teacher that you is one of your prized teachers is fundamental to you succeeding in that. So you've got this balancing act where you want to ensure that your business can sustain a teacher coming and going while still retaining a teacher that may come and go. Right? I'm going to open by saying this, that one of the most common misconceptions that we've had here at the factory is that we can somehow control or mold or sculpt all of our teachers' aspirations and futures, right? Like, in other words, here's you have a teacher who their long-term goal is to play in an orchestra, but they have a long-term goal, right? Currently, where they are in their life is serving your long-term goal, right? So it's mutually beneficial, the relationship is right now. And if we want to maintain that mutually beneficial relationship for as long as it can be, then we need to find a way to be in support of what their goals are in addition to your goals. There's a balancing act there, right? And in some ways, we're just saying the obvious, right? You can't force, like, humans aren't, like, coerced for very long into actions. Like anytime we're feeling manipulative, it's because we are manipulating the situation and it won't sustain. It's just like it doesn't. I mean, all we have to do is take ourselves out of our entrepreneurial role and put ourselves into our life role and just look at the friendships that last. Friendships are the last are the ones where we're mutually beneficial and we keep showing up year after year, you know, and they're not, you're not always available for them and they're not always available for you, but you make it work. So that's number one, is to just sort of, we have to check ourselves. And that's a super hard one, because we're, if you're as committed to systems as you are, and as we are, Daniel and I are, we think that a system is sort of like a bulletproof system, means that it's going to work always, every 12 months with everyone.
Right.
But the reality is we need to create systems that allow sometimes for a summer 3-month absence, which between you and I will only make them a better teacher. Right? The fact that they're actually in a pit playing or what doing whatever she's doing at a festival, that's actually going to make her a stronger for the students she's mentoring. Having said that, there is a responsibility that she has to the students at the school. And I'm going to share this. I'm going to ping it back to you, Daniel, which is that when we have a teacher, like, let me give you a concrete example. We have a great teacher at the factory here who, oddly, he's in David Duchovny's band. So periodically he goes and plays for like 4 weeks in Europe or whatever. And if early on in his career at the factory, it would have been like an impossible ask, because he would have left it for the whole month of November. And we'd be like, that's not how we operate. But it didn't happen early on. It happened like 3-4 years into his career. And so we said, we'll give it a try. How do you think we should approach your students so that they stay connected to you, even though we're going to have a sub in here for the 4 or 5 weeks that you're gone? And so Davis did a couple of amazing things. One, he started a blog where he shared it with all the families, and he just posted photos every other day from his tour. Right. And he was like, check out what I'm doing now. And so he just stayed in constant contact with the families over the course of the tour, so that they felt connected to him. Number two, he onboarded the teacher to make sure that the teacher who was subbing was totally prepared so that they could be in service to those students over the 4 weeks. So does your teacher have a responsibility to her students? Of course she does. She needs to be part of that temporary teacher that you bring in succeeding. Is it going to cost you a little bit of time and effort? Of course it is, Scott. You're probably going to have to pay that temp teacher an extra week or two to shadow the teacher you want. And then you're going to ask that teacher to share with the families about her experience at the festival over the course of the summer and stay connected. Does it have to be every week? Probably not. But like, you just guys decide, like 3 times this summer, you're going to shoot out an email to all your students about the festival and how much you're looking forward to seeing them in September. Like, that's the solution I would come up with. And then understand that if you work with her in a way that she feels supported and your business feels supported, then you're going to come back in the fall and you're going to be pleasantly surprised. Will she be around 3 years from now? Probably not. You and I probably already know that, right, Scott? But she's likely coming back this fall. Dig it? So, Daniel, thoughts on your end?
Yeah, a couple things. I think the thing that stood out to me most about this with Scott was that the prospect that it could, quote unquote, encourage bad behavior. I wonder, Nate, if you have any thoughts about how you all structure compensation at Brooklyn Music Factory, because you don't just get like, so for instance, there's retention bonuses. There are ways that pay are broken down so that they're overall, do you see what I'm getting at here?
Yeah, yeah. How do you encourage?
Do you think that plays into this at all?
Let me share one tactic that we use at the factory. I think we've done a good app on this, but we'll have to look that up and put it in the show notes. But we do a thing, Scott, called re-enrollment bonuses. So right now, and I know you run through the summer, as you know, BMF does heavy on camp, and then we do some summer lessons, but we don't. It's not a 12-month commitment in the private lesson program, right? So, but we offer right now, so we're recording this in April, starting in May, we spend the entire month of May getting commitments from our families for the fall, right? So our goal will be like 75% of all families are committed to the fall by paying a deposit. It's like $95 to hold your spot in the fall. But what we do is we empower the teachers to be part of that process, and the teachers get a re-enrollment bonus for every student that commits to the fall. So it's like $20 an enrollment. But then if they re-enroll over 50% of their students by June 1st, and it's not like they're the ones who are the only one managing that re-enrollment scheduling process, because they're not, right? Our enrollment team is, but they're the ones communicating. But if they re-enroll over 50%, then they get like a $250 bonus on their June paycheck. They re-enroll over 75%, they get another $250. So we invest about $6,000 in our re-enrollment bonuses every spring with our faculty. Now, why do we do that? For two reasons. Number one, we want them to have additional earning opportunities that also benefit the business, right? And number two, we want them invested long-term in the fall and in the school, right? So having them already thinking about what it's going to be like in the fall, who's coming back, how they're serving them, et cetera, and the fact that they get some reward for that is really beneficial for everybody, right? It increases teacher retention. And that's kind of like one of the underlying features here of this question, is that we all know that student retention goes up if teacher retention goes up, right? That's the bottom line. So we're in the people business because we're learning how to recruit, hire better teachers who are, as my partner put it yesterday in our People Power meeting, how many of you are looking for a job and how many of you are looking for a career? And as school owners, we're trying to balance that, because we're not going to get everybody who's a career educator, but it sure would be nice to have a core teaching group that are hoping to be there for 3 to 5 years, and for you to be designing a school with a compensation and benefits package that actually gives them the opportunity to be there for 3 to 5 years. Even if that's a long-term goal, it doesn't have to be a one-year goal. That's like a 3 to 5 year goal, you know?
Yeah. Just pursuant to that, there's something I would add, which is complementary to what Nate's saying, but from a very different angle. And this is that labor is one of the strategic vulnerabilities of a school.
Totally.
And the response to this is either A, put incentives in place for people to stay so that you reduce the number of times that something like this would happen. Obviously, you've been in business for a long time, Scott. This is the first time you've ever had something like this happen. It can be one of those things where it feels like you're a little bit blindsided simply for the fact that, well, I never thought someone would do this, you know? And we have those things that happen throughout our business. And fascinatingly enough, every year we have some new black swan event that we never considered before. And then it's like, oh, we're scrambling to do this. And when we're in business long enough, we just begin to realize, oh, these kinds of events are the norm, but they're never the same. And so if we anticipate in advance the kinds of strategic vulnerabilities that can most hurt our business for the type of business that we are, then, so for instance, the strategic vulnerability of a single teacher music school, sorry, a single teacher music studio is that, oh, I broke my foot.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be in rehab for 4 weeks. What do I do about my income? That would be different than if you own a music school with 12 teachers and you had a teacher break their foot and they're going to be gone for 4 weeks. Same issue. Human has a broken foot. Very different strategic vulnerability. Much bigger for the music studio, for the single teacher music studio that's teaching out of his or her home.
Yeah.
Similarly, the strategic vulnerability of this person leaving. We begin to think, well, how do we decrease this? And I would just say that one of the things that Nate was alluding to here, like these retention bonuses or the re-enrollment bonuses, things like that, provide a strong magnetic force for the teacher just to make different decisions to begin with. Part of it can be being much more declarative in the hiring process as to what people are signing up for, which, this being one of your best teachers, if not your best teacher, probably wouldn't have been, that wouldn't have been as relevant in this situation, but it could be with someone in the future. Structuring pay different, as I said, or, and this has actually happened at our studio in Northern Virginia, if you're running large-scale group classes, teachers are largely interchangeable, where a child doesn't have an attachment to any one teacher. What we've noticed is they just have attachments to the teacher team. And so we're actually able to give our teachers at the Piano Express studio large chunks of time off during the summer if they want them. And it literally doesn't impact revenue. It doesn't impact anything because we have subs that can just come in and teach the classes because those teachers are interchangeable. So this, and that was actually a conscious choice on our part to build our program that way, so we didn't have the strategic vulnerability. And that's really what I'm talking about. It's like, how do we structurally manage out our biggest vulnerabilities? And let me just even say, which this could feel very, very unrelated, but let me just even talk about a different one. A strategic vulnerability we have, let's say in Grow Your Music Studio / Seven Figure Music School, is billing systems, because all of our clients are remote, right? We actually have two backup credit card processors. And that actually came in handy because one of ours went down in the last year. Literally had, if we'd only had one, we would literally had no way to charge any of our clients. And within 24 hours, my two operations people had the problem solved in terms of billing, simply because we had two backups that we never use. So that's what I'm talking about when you're looking at, like, what are the biggest vulnerability points in our business? And again, this, the one that you're talking about, Scott, is specifically staff, but I'm talking, think across your entire business. What would grind the gears of your business to a halt if it were to happen? Think about those things. Start thinking in advance how you might address those, and structuring and building the business in such a way that you manage those out or greatly reduce the odds of that risk event happening to you and it crippling you, you know? So, yeah. Scott, any, oh, shoot. I've got people in the waiting room, like, waiting to come in. Scott, any follow-up to this or anything you would like us to add to what you've been saying, to what we've been saying here?
I put in the chat about my concern about losing the families for the summer. They just take the news and they say, okay, well, we'll just take a pause. And Nate replied to that the strategy of having that sub come in and shadowing and getting to know the kids should offset some of that. But I think that's a great point. And I think the implication is I may have to take a few lumps here, no matter what. Would you guys agree that that's probably the case? No matter how I handle this, there is going to be, as you say, some exposure, you know.
Short-term pain, long-term gain.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. So I would assume that you'll keep 80% of our students all summer is the number that I would aim for, if, you know, and know that this is, your story is a not an uncommon one, Scott. You know, we felt it here at the factory. I'm sure some of our other guests here today are like, oh yeah, I have the same situation. So what I look to do is set a target that's realistic for the business. 80% of those students, okay, I can live with that. And then her returning for another full year of generating revenue and nurturing students and being a A-list teacher for you, that's long-term gain.
Yeah, that sounds great. And honestly, the suggestions that you gave me are fantastic. I'm going to get a plan together. I appreciate it very much.
Sweet. Love it. Great question.
Yeah. And I think just that idea of creating the plan, certainly part of that plan, you're probably already thinking about it, Scott, is just, okay, when she comes back, how can we get her involved with the re-enrollment of the students that perhaps are being a little bit slower to respond to my emails or phone calls or texts? Would be just a really terrific strategy or thing to consider. Okay. There's a related question. And this was one of those questions that actually I did a double take because they were so similar. I wondered if it was the same person. They'd submitted the question twice. So this is clearly on people's minds. These come from Julia and Olinka. Julia just wrote, here's our challenge. how to select a group of committed, engaged, and reliable A player instructors. So as I said, kind of related to what you were just saying, Nate. And then Alinka, what she wrote, her version of this was, I've owned a music school for over 30 years, but the challenge after surviving COVID is continue building a community of teachers who care for this music school community versus people who want to show up, teach their hours, and wait for the paycheck. Question is, how do you grow a community of teachers who continue to care to grow our next caring generation? And I will just say, we did an episode on this, and I think it was our third episode ever, December 1st, 2022. We released this episode. Are you just selling time in your music school? Episode 3. You remember that, Nate?
Yeah, well, we were kids back then, but yes, I do remember. Yeah. No, that was a long time ago. I feel like we did a more recent one too on like nurturing and retaining great teachers, but anyways, I'll search that.
Well, do you want to jump in on this and I'll look through the episode list?
Yeah, take a quick peek.
Yeah, which by the way, I will say this. I'm just going to make a commercial here in the podcast. We are going to be releasing an episode guide. In fact, by the time this one comes out, this is going to be episode 123. We might have already released it. Bethany's putting the finishing touches on it. She's waiting for me to do some work on it. But we will have an indexed guide to all of our episodes sorted by category, episode number, date release, like all this sort of thing. So that you can group all of the episodes by like a certain topic. So if you're having trouble with student retention, we'll have all those episodes. Teacher hiring funnel, we'll have all those episodes. So you can just quickly find the topic that you perhaps are struggling with in your school. So anyway, I just thought I'd say that. But Nate, do you have thoughts about what Julia and Alinka said while I look for this other episode?
Yeah, I also just put in a chat there a great app we did on how to retain students when a teacher quits. Scott, I feel like that'd be beneficial to you or anybody else who has that on their mind. Put it in the chat with a link there. So first of all, this is like the million-dollar question, right? Which is around... it is a culture question at its core. So when we're using language like committed, engaged, reliable, i.e. how to select a group of committed, engaged, and reliable A player teacher instructors, committed, engaged, and reliable, this is very much, you're basically saying out loud your core values for your school. We only hire We're committed to our students and we only hire committed teachers, et cetera. Reliable. Like these are very important words to make sure we're not just keeping in our journal or whipping off in a Q&A for Daniel and Nate. We want to sit with these words and be like, okay, hold on a sec. What's missing right now in my school? Am I actually communicating the ethos within which we live and teach and work by here at the school? Okay, so first of all, it's a core issue. When you've been in music school for over 30 years, right, Alinka, you definitely have a serious culture. 30 years is a long time for doing anything. 30 years is longer than I've been married, right? So that's a long time that you guys have been at it. So what's amazing about that is baked in, you've probably made a whole bunch of really beautiful choices around this school, but you've also probably made a bunch of poor choices too. And some of those poor choices have been around culture. And what that means specifically for us when we talk about finding great teachers, retaining great teachers, is that we've kept teachers on that have been toxic, that have not been living and working to our values. We have had staff members that maybe were good enough, but they weren't really actually committed to our ethos as a school. Every time that we have a human every time we have someone at Brooklyn Music Factory who's in a working capacity and there's sort of a question around a values or purpose fit, it's like the most painful part of my job by far, because I know that I have to unhire them. It's time to coach them out. And that part of the gig, frankly, sucks. Like, I think we can all agree, right? We don't, that's not what we love. However, if that person stays around, because it's not a good fit for them either, they're not happy here, and it shows. When they just show up for a paycheck, those are the people that you know you're going to need to coach out. Now, it means you put a whole bunch of new pressure on yourself, because your hiring and your recruiting is going to have to go slower than you'd like it. And it's going to take more effort than you want. And you probably would rather spend time on marketing and sales or other things. But actually, you probably need to spend more time in people power and hiring, right? Hiring the right people. So that's kind of a bummer, because that changes your next six months strategic goals, or your next 12 months, right? Back to what Daniel, you were saying about, you know, where are the strategic holes. If we're really questioning the types of teachers that we're attracting and retaining, then that means you have a real strategic issue. Because you probably aren't very clear about who the right fit is. And you're not, and so you got to get clear about that. That means you literally have to know what your values are. You have to know what the hard skills are, i.e., how good a teacher do they need to be, and how good are you at training them? And then what are the soft skills? Those are primarily values, right? So, and then certain things like they're a great consistent communicator. They will always be on time. Those are the soft skills that they need to have, right? But once you figure those things out, then you need to build your recruitment and hiring funnel that takes as long as it friggin' needs to take to try to find people that are as close, check as many of those boxes as possible. That part is crucial. Like, for example, and then I'm going to ping it back to you, Daniel. One of the things that we forget to do at BMF, because we get so excited by a great teacher who has a great demo, seems to check all the values, is that we forget to just wait until all three references come in and read their references. Right? We're just so super excited. We're like, this person's amazing. They came from a pre-K. They're going to be perfect for Mini Keys and Jamban 101. Their classroom management skills are incredible. You know, they're joyful. They discover everyone's story. They check enough values boxes. And then we're like, we don't need to wait for the references. But then a reference comes in and they're not very organized. And sometimes they're late. And they have these certain skills where we're like, oh, that's not going to work here. Because we're like a hyper buttoned up school. Like our curriculum, everything, you're checking boxes, sending reports every single day. Like if you're struggling with that sort of thing, or you're going to be late, it's not going to be good here. Right. So that's an example of like building your hiring funnel where you're like, okay, I'm going to take the 6 weeks that it takes to actually hire a great teacher. And I'm going to go through every step. And I think our listeners know, Daniel, like we all know, first of all, we trust our gut. If we've been doing it for 30 years, you're very clear on your intuition. So you trust that. You trust your heart in hiring. But now you just need a real checklist system to ensure that you move methodically through it as you recruit, interview, demo, get references, contemplate as a team, and then decide yes or no, right? So we know what we need to do, I think, on it.
Yeah. Before I jump into my contribution to these questions, I just want to point out a few things. And we can drop these in the show notes. Ton of episodes around this idea. Episode 8, called Struggling to Find Teachers to Hire in a Music School, or How to Solve That Problem. Episode 11, How to Retain Students When Teachers Quit, Step by Step. Episode 55, Teacher Discipline and Staff Policies. You will find that the policies you put in place will elevate your staff or make them feel unfocused and not inspired. And a strong onboarding sequence and culture indoctrination in their first little bit can literally raise the excitement level of someone. You know, that old bubblegum commercial from the 90s. You don't have a second chance to make a first impression. I think it was that. It was like Juicy Fruit or something, or Wrigley's Spearmint Gum. I don't know. Then episode 67. Oh, this is going back to what Scott said. Don't lose students that you love. Episode 67. So, yeah, a lot of episodes we've done around this topic. I would just say, again, following on to some of the comments I just made there, that if a recipe for stress, a recipe for feeling as if you're on an endless treadmill for your career is to try to control the actions of others or try to motivate, model, manipulate people into doing things you want or feeling ways that you want them to feel. It's better to increase the value side, the things that you can control, so that you're actually attractional to people. In other words, create a work environment where people want to come and stay versus bringing out the stick or guilting people, or and this is probably the one that I see the most, just hoping and then feeling hurt when your staff doesn't do what I thought they cared more about the school, because you never voiced any expectations or agreements. You made assumptions about what they were thinking. You hoped for things. You basically were giving to get back. And then when they don't give back in the way that you imagine they would, you feel hurt or you feel angry or you feel like, you feel cynical. You feel resentful. It's best just to let them be them, create something as awesome as you can on your side of the equation, and then understand that you've greatly increased your odds to attracting really, really good people. Here's the other thing. You want to attract people that are excited, pay them more. And again, not to beat a dead horse, but that is one of the advantages of using a group lesson system. I won't belabor this point, but obviously we have Piano Express now, but even before we were doing Piano Express from grouplessons.com, prior to that, I was teaching a different model of teaching group. And many, many years ago, there was a school owner. They had over 500 kids in their school. She reached out to me, and one of the most odd, and trust me, this story will be very poignant to those who are listening. One of the most odd ways that a conversation started. So she had booked a call with me, got on, and the first thing out of her mouth, it wasn't the usual like awkward small talk. It was like, "Hey, I know you, but you don't know me." I was like, "Okay, this is interesting. This is very interesting." I'm gonna cut to the chase and make the long story short. Basically, a music school owner that I had mentored in this very large city in the U.S. I had mentored this particular person. I had mentored her in my group lesson system. And because they were teaching group lessons, she had raised her teacher pay to above market rates for her city. Because since they had higher margins, they could afford to pay their teachers more. And essentially, this other owner of this school with 500 plus students had lost 4 teachers in the space of 12 months to this school. And this other teacher wasn't even trying to poach the teacher. She was just putting the word out, "Hey, this is what we're paying at our school." And so, the owner who I was on the phone with was basically like, so I actually reached out to one of these people and asked where she'd gone to. And I dug and found out that they were teaching group in this particular way. And I want you to teach me to do what they're doing. Here's the other piece. The school that had attracted those 4 teachers, I know that owner very, very well. I was actually just texting with her for like 15 minutes last night. She's more like, she's a friend, a professional friend. She's an old client of mine. And I know that their teacher retention is very, very good. Student retention is very, very good. And again, it's just one of those things where people respond to incentives. So that is a very practical way to do what I was referring to in a more theoretical way at the beginning. Increase the value side of the equation. How do you do that? Pay them more. Give them better benefits. Like we did a whole episode on employee benefits. Nate, you guys give people a membership to City Bike there in Brooklyn, don't you? Like there's things that you do that are just kind of, right?
It's on the benefits package coming up. It's not there yet, but we've done things like that.
Yeah.
And Actually, we had a couple questions in here around incentives and around just what percentage of student tuition do you pay teachers. Helen asked that. And
oh, we have an episode on that, actually. What percentage should... Yeah, episode 49. What percentage of tuition should teachers keep? That's literally the title of the episode. So I guess before we get into like addressing some of the comments there, I think the big thing that I want to put here is that people will tend to be a neutral and will, you know, unless what they're getting into generally is what they consider their dream job, people will tend to consider the job more transactional. It is up to us as the business owner to create something that inspires them to be bigger than that. We can't just expect people to show up inspired. We have to do things. And what I would say is that culture changes and things that might motivate the new generation of worker that might have motivated the old generation of workers maybe isn't as motivational to a new generation of workers. I was actually just reading an article on Forbes, and I don't remember what the article was called. I don't even know if I had the link for it anymore. But it was something around like they were exploring the differences between the motivations of millennials versus Gen Z. Fascinating. I hadn't even considered this, even though intuitively it makes sense. And so it just goes back to basic business. If you want to understand how to make better sales, go ask your customers what they want. Go ask them what their pain points are. Go dig into the psychology of your customer. The same thing is true of your staff. If you want to know what's going to make your business more attractive to work for, if you want to know what's going to inspire someone to think of this more than just a very mercenary, cold transaction, you've got to talk to them. You've got to speak with them. You've got to understand what they're thinking. And then just maybe the last thought, and then I'll kick it back to you, Nate, because I know I've been talking a lot. But the last thought is, even in some of the workers that I've worked with over the past few years, it's so fascinating. Just, I spend a lot of time with new people, and it's so fascinating how in the first few meetings, I'll feel their excitement level rising as I share my vision, as they see my excitement and passion for what I do, as they see how, even at the very beginning, I'm asking them for pushback, open to criticism. That first time that they realize that I'm not joking around when I say that I actually want them to criticize my ideas, or I want them to speak up if they feel uncomfortable, or if I want them to speak up about things, like I consider a badge of honor. Like literally, I was in just a week ago today, actually, I was in a meeting with a high-level worker of mine, and we were 15 minutes in this meeting, and I could tell something was up with this person. Something was off. And I looked her right in the eye and said, hey, what's wrong? I can tell something's wrong. And she had a huge issue she wanted to bring up with me that she said she was kind of afraid to bring up. But as soon as I gave her that emotional and conversational space to bring it up, it just all got laid out on the table. And it was an issue we needed to deal with. And something that not only she said, but other people I've worked with over the years have said is that they actually believe they can speak their mind. And again, that especially for like age 20 through 35, that's huge right now, that ability to be transparent. Whereas I think older generations, just according to this Forbes article and other things, I just know it's different for the older generation. They kind of don't care as much as these younger employees and team members. It's a bigger value for them than some of the older team members that we have. Though in general, it's important across the board. But anyway, just some thoughts about how to increase that value side. Nate?
I have a quick couple shares here. But then, Daniel, I wanted to ask you a question about culture, because you were just out here hanging out at Brooklyn Music Factory. Mm-hmm. And you made a comment about our culture. And so I'm going to come back to you on this, because I'm curious if you could point to one or two or three specifics that you just observed or felt while being at the factory, you know, like, i.e. this is something that's palpable here. First, let me answer the easy question. Percentage of student tuition should you pay teachers? This is by product. When Daniel talks about group lessons versus private lessons, it's by product, right? You have a product suite. I know that like Greg School does both private lessons and group lessons, right? So he has a different pay structure But we just did our quarterly planning yesterday. So 4 hours of quarterly planning, and one of my the way I prepare is with lots of data pieces and stories and sheets and reports for the team, and one of which was a cost of labor. And so these are the real percentages as of yesterday. So this is all from first quarter, Helen. In our group classes, 20 cents of every dollar goes to the teacher. Right? So you're like, whoa. But that's because it's a higher margin on a group class. 35 cents of every dollar goes to the private lesson teacher. And those are the only two relevant ones. Now let me give you comps. So 1 year ago today, in our first quarter of 2023, we spent 19 cents of every dollar on our group classes and 31 cents of every dollar on private lessons. We've made a concerted effort to raise the rates that we're paying our teachers over the last... One of our goals is to raise them even more, right? So increase cost of labor, but reduce other lines of expenses so that we maintain our net income. And our, I'm sure I've talked about this on other apps. We have some good financial fluency apps, but you know, our goal at BMF is a 20% net. That's our goal, right? So regardless of the amount of dollars we bring in, that's what our goal is. So those are the percentage numbers. And then a couple of questions that have come up in the chat, Daniel, have been around how to actually just find teachers, find anyone who's interested. So there's, well, we've done some cool episodes on this too, but just in brief, I'll say, we use Indeed, and if you're going to use a recruitment tool like Indeed, then you have to invest in that tool, understanding how to use it as well as you'd invest in any other tool. Like if you've gone through, you know, Daniel's marketing class, he has a whole thing on developing Google Ads. Don't expect that you're going to get a return on Google Ads without the time investment. Don't expect you're going to get a return on Indeed recruitment without the time investment. Right, so expect to spend 3 to 5 hours learning how to use the tool really well to actually get people to find you when searching for a job. Okay, that's number one. Number two, your personal network is way stronger than you realize. So I remember when Daniel and I first started hanging out together, he was like, dude, here's what we're going to do. You're going to ask three friends, you're going to ask three school owners to recommend three friends. And it's just the rule of threes that Daniel taught me, and I've been using it ever since. Anytime I need to find anything, like a dentist, I just ask a friend if they know of anybody, and then I ask, you know, and then I just keep going out. I'm like, hey, I ask all friends if they can recommend three dentists. Anybody, you know, like you just keep asking for other friends who might know of a good dentist. And eventually, after you put in a few weeks of searching, you're going to end up probably with a decent dentist that works, that takes your insurance, et cetera, right? The same holds true for your personal network. The last thing I'll say is your current teacher network is way stronger than you realize. So teachers that work for you now, teachers that used to work for you, of course, you only want to inquire with the ones that you consider to be a good fit, but you want to go to them and you want to make sure that they have a link to your Indeed ad, that they have a link, they know exactly that they can recommend your school. And you want to treat that them like you would anybody else. If you really need to get a new hire done, you need to poke and nudge your circle. Poke, nudge, poke, nudge, poke, nudge. We don't offer any hiring referral bonus. We just say you're a badass and we really appreciate you. Is there any way I can be of benefit to you? And they're like, well, actually, I have a concert coming up. And you say, I'll send it out an email supporting you, right? You don't pay money. Money is the cheapest, easiest thing. Pay with your time. That's yeah. worth way more. Time 100%. And attention is much better for your network than money.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me, even pursuant to that thought, how resistant I found some schoolers to be to actually spend time with their director levels, with their admins, with their internal support team, where I've literally had to tell people I'm coaching, like, no, have a standing meeting with them every week. I don't have time. And then they don't see the disconnect between why their admins can only handle like level one tasks and never ascend in the complexity of the things they can handle. They don't see the connection between that. Investment always precedes what you want, whether that's people being more invested in your school, feeling inspired, being able to handle larger, more complex projects, or actually even being able to build entire parts of your business for you, which I've experienced. There are things that some of my support team can do that I would, in a million years, never would have guessed that I could just hand that off to someone. But it's because I've spent so much time with them.
You know, Daniel, I've been thinking about that exact, this concept of like momentum in relationships. So think about it for a second. Like you were talking about texting with a former client last night. Like we all have the moments when we're trying to get a piece of information. It might be like, hey, we're looking for recommendations of new teachers. Hey, we're looking for a last family to enroll in that last spot on our summer camp or whatever it is. There's this idea that I keep coming back to that is that we develop a momentum in a process or a project. And the people are far more important than the project. And so what I mean by that is, let's say you know what the outcome of the project is. You need to hire a new voice teacher. That's the result you're looking for. But when you text like four of your previous voice teachers a quick hello and you say, hey, you know, wondering how everything's going wherever they're living now, and they respond, it's going great, so good to hear from you. And you respond, hey, have you made any new music lately? Send me a link to the music. And they send you a link to their, you know, Spotify playlist. And you're like, man, this sounds great. Question for you. I'm looking to hire a new voice teacher who might be even half as good as you. Can you recommend like three or four friends that are currently in the city? And you develop a momentum in a conversation with them just on your phone. Be very careful, because this is what Daniel's referencing. Don't just give up on the momentum. Stay with the conversation. Don't just like give a task to one of your staff people and then not meet with them again for 3 weeks. Show up consistently and develop a momentum around the project, because it's not about the project, it's about the people, because the people are the actual ones that are going to give you, that are actually going to be doing the work and developing what you're actually trying to create. It doesn't matter if it's finding the best next voice teacher or doing some sort of what you consider like simple admin task, right? You have to stay with the people and stay in momentum on it until you're like, great, this project's done. I wonder what we're going to do next. And I don't know if that was a little abstract, but it's like I've been sitting with it a ton because, Daniel, I've been thinking about like we're just trying to finish the last piece of the very last tiny detail in our new space to have the whole thing signed off. And it's taken like a year. And yes, all I'm doing is showing up to like the electrician every 3 weeks whenever he finds time to come and ask him how he's doing, ask him what he needs, and hope you'll keep showing up until we get to the finish line. Because Lord knows, I don't know when we're actually going to get to the finish line, but I know that this dude is a key component. So I just keep texting him, keep showing up, keep calling him. And then whenever he shows up, which he's supposed to at 4 o'clock today, I'm like, thank you for showing up again.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and read the question. And I put this one in order this way because I think these topics just kind of flow right into one another. This third question has some DNA in the previous question, which was how do you basically motivate the teachers? How do you inspire them? All right. This new one was, what is your suggestion or secret? What is your suggestion or secret for motivating students to work independently at their instrument? That Carol Lee asked this question. By the way, this was for the last live we did. We never got to this one. And then there was a related question by Winona, and then I grouped these two together. How can I motivate my young students ages 4 to 6 years to practice at home? And so I think these two have some common ground between the two. I will just say even before, and Nate, I don't know if you want me to start or you want to start, but I will just say, I would frame this by saying there are two ways to do motivation. Intrinsic motivation, which comes from inside the human. There's extrinsic, where outward things motivate. So that's like the incentives we were talking about with teachers. I will add that I think extrinsic motivation can lead to creating intrinsic motivation. And that's one that I'm particularly fascinated with. And when it comes my turn to answer this question, that's kind of where I'm going to go. But I will point out that a great extrinsic motivator are fun things for students to do in lesson, like our sponsor, Big Music Games. Mm. Nate, do you want to talk about Big Music Games?
Yeah, it's funny because I was just thinking, like, I've been rereading for like the sixth time Atomic Habits this morning.
Dude,
I was reading it.
Not kidding. I've got it right here. Wait.
I saw it. Right, yeah, you've been taking some notes in Evernote because it popped up. And I was like, oh, nice. Daniel's reading it. But he has this great core principle, and it's in the name Atomic, which is that we're only looking for small incremental shifts from our students, especially in the early years. And one of the fundamental shifts for a human that begins their music journey, there you go, great read, yep, love it, is that we just want them to engage in any way, shape, or form at home. So we love it when it follows a prescripted plan that we have for our musician's journey, but it doesn't always need to. It just needs to be some kind of engagement at home with the idea of them. And James Clear makes this really great point in chapter 2, where he talks about our habits develop from our identity. And so what we're actually trying to do is identify these students. We're trying to get them, speaking of intrinsic, we're trying to get them to identify themselves as a musician. At BMF, we always just say as a music nerd. And so Big Music Games, which is, you know, four fluencies, rhythm, harmony, melody, songwriting, we, in the early years, we approached it entirely as just like a music nerd game. Like, hey, every music nerd does this. We play games. That's what we love to do. And so all I'm actually doing and all we're actually doing as teachers here at the factory in the first couple few years of working with our students on their hopefully 10-year journey here is helping them re-identify. Just be like, oh, I now identify myself as someone who is a musician. And we honestly, I mean, that's where like a lot of the games come just from that space. Of course, there's all these long-term benefits to developing all these musical skills. But in the early years, we just want them to be like, dude, can you think of a great music game? And then they start describing random games with like frogs and elephants that they want to make. And you're like, awesome, because that means that they're identifying themselves as someone who makes music. So that's what that's all I'm going to share actually on how to get them to be motivated to play at home. Doesn't have to be games, but it has to be something where they're like, I identify as a musician and this is what musicians do. And they don't just do it at school. They also do it at home.
Yes. And I would just say, if you want more information about that, yes, I'm talking to you, then you need to go to bigmusicgames.com/7FMS and you can start gaming for free. Anyway, yep. Nate, question. That's a good entry into this answer. Any other thoughts you have about suggestions or secrets for motivating students to work independently of the keyboard or their instrument or motivating young students to practice at home? Or do you want to kick it over to me?
Let me share one last tactic that we do a bunch here, which is essentially the idea of an agenda. So let's say they're beginning to age into, they're starting to identify as a musician. They're showing up to their lessons every week. And you're just like, you're constantly validating their efforts. Even just showing up is the most important thing a musician can do. So here they are. What we've started doing is, and I've been testing this out a bunch with, I have a 7-year-old Abby who's in her first year. So she's already played one songwriting party. She's got some games she likes. She's already designed a game called the Pancake Chord Flip, which is her practicing like 3-note chords on the piano. And then she takes a poly spot and treats it like a pancake and flips it over onto a music stand, which is her griddle. Anyways, that's just like a game that she created. And so she's all in on this. And so lately what we've been doing is drawing an agenda on the board, like just literally checklist, the three things we're going to do at the lesson. And then she draws a heart and divides it into three parts. And as she finishes each section, she checks the box and then fills in the heart. And here's the value of that, is you're starting to break down the whole process for them. She's only seven. And she's kind of like owning stepping through a routine, like a little practice routine, right? And the fact that she draws a heart and fills it in is the most important part of that agenda tip, right? Because she's doing her version of process, not your version of process, her version. And so what we're going to do, what I'm starting to do with her and other students now, Daniel, is I'm being like, hey, do you have a dry erase board at home? Why don't you draw a heart at home every time you play and fill it in as you move through the process? So it's just like a tiny little tactic, but it has huge implications because it's back to your intrinsic. She's now designing her version of a practice routine or a play routine. And she's kind of filling that in. So that's the only other tip. Hopefully that's beneficial to folks.
Okay. All right. I have, and this is probably what we're going to end the episode on. So if you have any additional questions about not only this question, but any of the previous things we've said, write them in the chat now. I will again start by pointing out a few episodes we've done in the past that I think are relevant to the question at hand. We did, and this was just over 100 episodes ago, and remain two of my favorite episodes we ever did. Episode 23 and 24, it was a two-part episode. Nate basically took the mic for the entire first episode, and I took the mic for the second episode. We were originally going to do it together. We ended up talking for 2 hours and then splitting it into two episodes because we had so much to say. The episodes were titled How to Keep Students for 10 Years. That was Nate's episode. And then mine was called The Hidden Driver of Growth and Retention. And even though that sounds like retention episodes, there's actually a lot in there, especially in my episode, about how important it is that at the core of what you're doing, that you can have the best systems in the world, you can hire the best people, you can have the best systems, the best desk staff, you can be using the best software, but if at the core your product doesn't work, none of it matters. What I found is that there is a connection between how well the product works, I'm going to define that in just a second, and how much kids will practice or how much they will succeed at the keyboard. And again, I'm going to go back to what I said about the teachers. You cannot control the actions of others. And so you have to do everything you can to manipulate and control only the things that you can manipulate and control. Maybe manipulate isn't the best word because that's a loaded word. But basically, I thought, okay, as opposed to trying to fight the world and the trends in culture and the trends in parenting, what can I do to make the student succeed at the keyboard? Because actually, when it comes down to it, I don't even care if they practice at home. I don't care if they practice at home. We're asking the wrong question if we're asking, how do I get them to practice at home? It actually doesn't matter. And I'm going to explain why. Because we're running a business, and the purpose of the business is actually to keep the customers as long as possible and to provide as much value as possible. But if they don't have the same values that we do, and we're trying to give them something that they don't value, then we're actually failing as a business owner. And in this point, we identify too much as the teacher, too much as the musician, and not as much as the business owner. So we have to put down our teacher and musician. We have to take off our teacher musician hat and put on the business owner hat and say, what will keep them in for the longest amount of time with them experiencing the most amount of joy and happiness possible? It turns out the answer to that is very, very different than how do I get them to practice at home? Mm-hmm. If the child, and so for me, one of the best days in my career as a piano teacher came when I realized that actually, if they never practiced at home, but they stayed in my studio for 5 years, I wouldn't care. Because as soon as I let that go, I basically let go of all the things I was trying to do to manipulate an 8-year-old to do something I wanted them to do that was counter to what they want to do and what their parent was supporting them to do at home. Mm-hmm. And then the solutions I came up with were very, very different. And Interestingly enough, the solutions I came up with, which I talked about in episode 24, the solutions I came up with, actually then, as soon as I let it go, they actually started practicing more at home as a result of the things that I was doing that I came to because I let go of the idea of just obsessing over, or how can I get them to practice? How can I get them to love music more? As soon as I stopped trying to manipulate them, trying to control them, things got way, way better.
Daniel, you know, the Hormozi quote, which is basically there's only two ways to grow your business, either get more customers or get customers to spend more money. And you're referencing lifetime value. Basically, yeah. Retain your customers for longer means they'll spend more money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I think the retention piece is massive on this.
Now, I do want to say this because I know how teachers think, because I've seen the criticisms of how I talk sometimes. And I think the criticisms come from a fundamental misunderstanding. I am not saying to cynically just only care about money. People have criticized me, and I don't think that, but they've criticized me for that because they misinterpret what I just said. So I do just want to reiterate, I'm not saying only care about the money or only try to trick people into staying in your studio. No, when you actually know what it was that I did to get them to stay longer, it was actually, I stopped caring about anything but getting that kid to feel like the piano was easy. That became my obsession. All I cared about was making the product as good as possible. And it was, how do I make it feel easy to the child? Because if it feels easy to the child, then the child isn't complaining to the parent, and then the parent isn't quitting. Because kids don't quit, parents quit. And so when I began to understand like that and was honest about what my motivations were and how they were in conflict with what the parents' motivations were, and started caring more about the parents' motivations than my own, again, now I'm actually serving the customer as opposed to thinking everyone, oh, your child owes me practice. Again, when I released all this stuff, it was more of an emotional realization than it was like learning a business tactic or learning a teaching tactic or, you know, clapping hands or doing little music activities and little arts and crafts time music and trying to get on the treadmill of like, oh, I'll just give the kids music that they like to play and that'll keep them in the studio longer. All that stuff doesn't work long term. The only thing I found that reliably kept kids in the studio for a long, long time, helped them actually get good at the skill that their parents signed them up for, and kept them happy, and helped them become actual good musicians, as evidenced by our RCM scores in my studio, was just to make them as awesome as they possibly could. And I dropped everything else. If it did not support that goal, I didn't do it. And again, episode 24 really goes in much more depth to that. But I feel like, to answer this question appropriately, I wanted to address the emotional reality more than like just giving a laundry list of tactics to get kids to practice more, because end of the day, I don't believe that those things actually work.
Daniel, I love the emotional. I know we got to wrap this sucker, but I love that last piece you said, because it hit home for me. And I know we've talked a bunch about this, and I'm sure we talked about it in those two apps. But when you as a studio owner are very clear, like Daniel was, in terms of what his specific outcome was, he's like, you've said it actually even more concisely before. I've heard you say, I want them to learn how to read music quickly and I want them to get better at the piano. Like whatever that meant for you in terms of like getting better at the instrument, but actually it wasn't whatever it meant. You did it really specifically because you had RCM scores where you're like, I'm going to measure against this benchmark. So that's great. You were hyper specific about how you were measuring, and you were very specific on what you wanted your outcome to be. And I think, you know, at a place like Brooklyn Music Factory, which has a totally different outcome, i.e.,
yes, you know,
developing songwriters, developing musicians that are fluent and can express on multiple instruments. The emotion, where I felt that emotional weight that you were describing, where like, you're trying to convince, like you said it beautifully when you said, parents owe me practice. That's a classic, like limiting, just bummer of a way to go into the job site. Like mm-hmm. I'm trying, you owe me something. Actually, no, you were in service to the student. And what I have realized here at the factory is when I stay very engaged, you know, with our games, with the students, and celebrating their collaboration and original songs, then the rest of the stuff works itself out. i.e. I'm not spending my time having to convince parents of the methodology. I'm not spending my time trying to explain game-based learning like until my face turns blue, which truthfully, Daniel, it feels a little bit like what you're talking about. It felt like the wrong thing, like you owe me practice. You owe me a better understanding of game-based learning. No, parents don't owe me anything. I'm in service to these kids and we know what the outcome's supposed to be. And sure, I should try to describe like the benefits of big music games to parents from the main stage at a gig, but that's not how I should spend most of my time, which is kind of what I hear and what you're saying. And it was nice for me to, you know, I'm reminded of when sometimes I feel tension, it's around trying to convince the parents of methodology's approach and long-term benefit. Instead of just being like, no, I'm in service to your child, and watch, your child is about to take the main stage and collaborate with a bunch of other musicians on an original song. That's the evidence of success, like passing an RCM level.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like passing an RCM level would feel the same way for me if that was our measure of success. You know, like, watch, my student can now do this. And actually, I'll add a little asterisk. To be clear, when some of our students get up to the teen levels, a lot of the measures of success is they get into the arts high school here. And so we actually do shift some of our purpose and measurement, you know, after they finish the songwriter's journey, et cetera. So it's interesting to know that you can actually, you can change your benchmark as your students age into your, through your program, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I could say so much more about this, but we got to go. Thank you everyone for coming here.
Hey, it's Nate again. You know, every year at Brooklyn Music Factory, we get dozens and dozens of great reviews from our families. And you want to know how? Because we ask them. And they're happy to leave a review because of the positive impact that we've made on them. And so now I have a simple ask for you. If this podcast, the 7FMS podcast, was helpful to you, would you mind leaving a review for Daniel and I? And please share the podcast with another music school owner that you think might benefit. It's one of the best ways that you can support us. We appreciate it.